It's a pleasure to introduce Thomas Holoyan, who will talk about insights into the local supernova population from ASSM.
Okay, so thank you for the opportunity to speak. For those who haven't met me, which is probably most of you, my name is Tom Holoyan. I'm a Carnegie Fellow at Carnegie Observatories in Pasadena. And I'm a founding member of the All Sky Automated Survey for Supernovae, or SASIN. So I typically am working on the supernova side of things. I also do a lot of work with tidal disruption events that I won't be talking about today, but I'm happy to chat about afterwards if you're interested. So today I'm just going to talk a little bit about our survey, since we're probably not familiar to most of you, and then I'll talk about a couple studies I've been doing recently on local type 1a supernovae, particularly their progenitor systems. All right, so ASSM stands for the All Sky Automated Survey for Supernovae, as I mentioned, and our goal is to survey the entire night sky on as rapid a cadence as possible to find bright and nearby transients. So to do this, we use small telescopes. Each of our units consists of four telescopes on a common mount, and our lenses are 14 centimeters, so quite small. We started in 2013 with a unit in Hawaii, and then in 2014, we added our second one in Chile, which gave us both hemispheres in coverage. And then in 2017, we expanded and added three more units, one in Texas, one in South Africa, and then a second one in Chile. So this now gives us the ability to cover the entire sky on a much faster cadence. Also gives us some redundancy in the case of bad weather or mechanical issues. And finally, we're adding a new one right now that we're hoping will be online pretty soon in China. Once that one is online, the sun will never rise on our telescope network, which is pretty cool. So the reason we focus on these bright objects is that really most professional surveys don't do this. They're typically looking much deeper, which gives you more volume and more discoveries. But the ones that we're trying to find are the ones that we can study in the greatest detail and for long periods of time. So that's sort of a key, because not only do we want very early time data, so we want high cadence to find these things early, and we want to build up nice light curves, but we also want to be able to get late time data, which you can't do with very distant supernovae unless you have a really, really big telescope. Typically, we can easily get spectra of our objects with 1 and 2 meter telescopes for quite a while, and then we can switch to larger apertures as we need to do things like nebular phase spectra. So currently we get about 6,500 images per night, weather permitting, and that lets us cover about 40,000 square degrees, which is more than the visible sky, so we're actually covering it on a sub-day cadence. We have G-band filters on all our telescopes, and that gives us a limiting magnitude of about 18.5, and we saturate at about 12th magnitude. We have everything about our data reduction is automated at this point, scheduling, reducing the data, subtracting it, doing source detection, all that is automated. And we announce everything publicly as soon as we confirm them via TNS or ATELS, just so that we can give them to the community and get the best science out of it that we can. So two things I want to point out. We have a public light curve tool at this URL here. You can go to that URL and put in any coordinates on the sky and get light curves going back to the start of our survey in 2013. We also have some databases like our variable star database, where we have pre-computed up-to-date light curves of different classes of objects. So for this one, you can go and pull up light curves for any variable star based on type, period, different characteristics, coordinates, all those kinds of things. So we're working on some more of those too to do supernovae and AGN and things like that. And then finally, one thing I want to say about our survey, and this is partly why I'm here, is that we have started working on tools to stack our data to look for low surface brightness objects. Things like supernova remnants, light echoes, and dwarf galaxies. So by stacking all our data, we can get down to a surface brightness of about 24 to 25 magnitudes per square arc second in crowded fields, and 27 to 28 magnitudes per square arc second in uncrowded fields. So that lets us see things like the filaments and the Vela supernova remnant over here. And then if we take our stacks on a year-by-year basis and subtract them, we can do things like look at the evolution of things that are changing, like light echoes. So this is the light echo of supernova 1987A. You can see it moving outwards over the course of the survey that we've been running, which is pretty cool. So this is all very preliminary. We're working on developing these tools right now. But if you're interested in this, let me know. We can talk about it a little more later. Okay, so Now I want to move forward and just talk about these scientific studies I've been working on. So primarily I've been looking at type 1a supernova progenitors, which, as I think many people here know, typically we have two pictures here. We have the single degenerate picture where you've got the white dwarf in a system with a non-degenerate companion from which it accretes, or the double degenerate scenario where you have two white dwarfs that collide through angular momentum loss or the Kozai-Lidov mechanism or something like that, causing them to run into each other and explode. So we think both of these channels play a role, but we don't know the exact proportion, what the total population looks like, and that can be very important to a lot of fields of astronomy. So we want to look for either smoking gun cases of one or the other, if we can find them, or look at large populations like the nearby sample that ASASIN provides. So I'll talk about a couple of these studies. So first, looking at a specific supernova, ASASIN 18BT, or supernova 2018-OH, was discovered last year by ASASIN in February. And when we found it, we noted that it was in a field that was being monitored by Kepler as part of K2. And this was about 48 megaparsecs away and had a peak magnitude of about 14.3, which makes it both the brightest and nearest supernova detected by Kepler by a large margin. And what that means is that we have a really exquisite light curve. So here I have the ASASIN G and V band, the Atlas orange band, and then the Kepler light curve right there. So really exquisite photometric precision and cadence that you just don't typically get with supernovae. Honestly, when I first saw this, I thought it was a model, not the actual data. So what's really interesting about this is if you focus on these first few days after discovery here, you can see there's sort of a bend in the light curve. And if you look at this in flux space, it's a little more obvious. So on the right here, these are the first about 10 days of the Kepler light curve, and we've fit a single power law model to the rise, which is typically what we do with type 1As. So you can see there's a lot of residuals here. And if we fit a double power law to this, we get a much better fit. So for the first 4 or 5 days, there's a different power law, and then after that, it rises. So basically, we call this two-component rise, and what we think is there's some other physical process that's bumping up the emission for the first few days, after which the supernova dominates. So what could this be and what can it tell us about the progenitor? So first and foremost, an early flux excess is predicted if you have a single degenerate progenitor system. And the reason for this is you have the white dwarf go off, the companion star is sitting there, the supernova ejecta hits it and strips a bunch of hydrogen helium-rich material off of it, creating blue flux excess at early times. So you'll get a bump, like here, this is a little cartoon of it. You'll get a bump at early time. So on the right here, we've done a model where we have a supernova power law plus a companion emission model. And you can see it's a pretty good fit to the data. From this, we can constrain the radius of any possible non-degenerate companion to be somewhere in the 10 to 25 solar mass range, so probably a subgiant if there is one there. So is this a smoking gun case of a single degenerate system? Not so fast. We have other ways that you can produce early flux excess. So another main one that we talk about a lot in our paper on this is this idea that if you have the radioactive nickel powering the light curve mixed out to the outer layers of the ejecta, you can get extra flux early on. So typically we have it all concentrated towards the middle, but if you have some of it mixed out to the outer layers, you can get extra flux. Now, all of these models here that I'm showing are just a smooth distribution where you just have a little bit of the nickel mixed to the outside, then it's smoothly distributed throughout the ejecta. These purple ones have it more mixed towards the outside, and red is more centrally concentrated. So you can see that if we overplot the Kepler light curve, it doesn't fit any of these models exactly. But if we sort of think of this as if we use a non-smooth distribution where we have some of the nickel mixed to the outside, about 15 to 20% towards the outer layers, and then the rest of it more centrally concentrated, you can get this early bump, and then it sort of goes down and follows one of these other paths later on. So we found in our paper this is a pretty good fit to the light curve. There is an issue with this, which is that this early flux excess you expect to be red colored. And what we find is that this actually is a blue flux excess in the beginning. But I'll get back to that in a minute and talk about why that may not be a problem. So we find this is a better fit to the data than the single degenerate model, although there was another paper about this, another discovery paper about this object, Dimitriadis et al., that found the opposite. So the nice thing about it is that these predict different things at later times. So specifically, if we look at this in the nebular phase, you should see in a single degenerate system, this strip material should be going moving very fast, so you should see eventually after the supernova light has faded a bit, broad lines from the strip material in hydrogen or helium, depending on the composition of the star. So we went and got a nebular phase spectrum of this, and these insets here just show different lines that we were looking for, Balmer lines and helium lines. So the red lines here are continuum fits, and then the blue lines are our limits on the flux for lines that we were expecting to see from the single degenerate model. These narrow lines are from the host. So what we found here is that we don't detect any strip companion material in these spectra. And we can put a limit based on the flux limit of the strip mass of about 0.006 solar masses of material, which is a lot less than you expect in a typical single degenerate system. So this is a big problem with the single degenerate model. However, like I said, you do have the issue of the early color with the nickel model. There are other things you can do to create early flux, like have it interact with CSM or some more exotic systems. But basically, the takeaway from this is that we do not have a model right now that can explain both the blue flux excess and this nebular phase spectrum that has no strip material in it. So we need to get more data on this, but this is an interesting case that requires more, more modeling to figure out what's going on. However, based on this, we did another study that I'm going to talk about where we looked at the nebular phase spectra of 110 type 1a supernovae. We have over 200 nebular phase spectra of these objects. Basically did the same thing that I just showed you for 18BT, where we look for these different lines that we expect to see from a strip companion. And so this case is supernova 2015F. Again, you can see we don't detect any lines here. And in fact, in our entire sample, we did not detect any that had clear detections of any Balmer lines or any of the helium lines we expect to see. This is just a random sampling of the different H-alpha regions. So what we did then is we took the flux limits for these and turned those into strip mass limits, and we get these distributions here. So these lines here, the blue, green, and red, are what the ranges you expect to see for subgiant main sequence and red giant companions for stripped hydrogen-rich material. And then over here is just different models for helium-rich material. So you can see that in most cases here, not only do we have very low limits, but almost none of these are even consistent with the models that we have. So based on that, we can put a limit of about 5.6 to 6% of type 1a supernovae at a maximum could be coming from the single degenerate channel based on these data. So just a quick summary, SASN is leading the professional surveys for bright nearby transients, not just supernovae, but tail disruption events, many other interesting things too. These early light curves with space telescope data have been really interesting, so they let us look for these early flux excesses like we found in 18BT. We've also done similar analysis with some test supernovae now, which there are many more of, so take a look at those. Our late time studies suggest that the double degenerate scenario is by far the most dominant, with single degenerate models providing only a few percent at most of the type 1a population. And I just want to highlight some other work that we've been doing with our sample, which has been on the specific and general supernova rates. So we published our first SASN rate paper last year. We were looking at the specific supernova rate, or 1A rate, with host mass. So we found that lower mass hosts have much higher specific supernova rates in them, and we were able to push the rate down to two orders of magnitude lower in host mass than previous samples were able to do. So we'll be looking at some few specific rates of star formation and metallicity, using some spectra I've been getting with Magellan, and also the general supernova rates in the near future, so please take a look for those. All right, thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions, comments? Yes, Pilar.
Okay. So regarding interaction with a progenitor, that was predicted by Dan Kaysen. And so it would be like really astonishing if he made this prediction and it's right in all the details, but for the wrong reason. I mean, he not only predicted that you should go out there and look for things at early times, that there would be a bump of about the right duration, but also the color, and about like that you wouldn't see it all the time, only a small fraction of the time. Like, every detail of that is right. And on the other end, you know, should we be able to see, you know, it after so many days in the spectra? That relies on two different theories. Like, one is the theory of stripping, which no real good 3D models have been done of that. So we don't, I mean, that's highly uncertain. And then the other is the radiative transfer part, which if you do it in different ways, you get like more than an order of magnitude difference in interpreting the spectra. So it just seems like the easiest explanation is that the theory of the late time stuff is wrong, the theory of the early time stuff is good.
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly possible. I think in both cases, we need to improve the theory and the modeling. I don't think you can reject the single degenerate channel at all for that, for Assassin 18BT yet. I think the fact that we didn't see the hydrogen lines was pretty surprising in that case, because it looked so good, the early time data was so clear, like such a good match with the prediction. And then there have been cases where we don't see the early bump, but then we do get the clear detections in the nebular phase spectra. So I agree, I think it's certainly possible that it is a single degenerate system that we just haven't figured out the way to reconcile the data and the models yet. And it is clear that single degenerate type 1As do exist, because we do find the occasional one that has nebular phase hydrogen or something like that. That seems to be a pretty clear case. So yeah, I think the jury's still out is the main point, that we need better modeling or better theory. Yeah.
Here there's a...
So for instance here, this is a host line. So this is coming from the host galaxy.
It's from the host galaxy.
Yeah.
And what about the helium? And can you say also that you don't see any helium
too? Yeah, so the lines that we do detect here, the clear detections are all from the host. We don't see, so we're expecting something with something around, I think, a couple thousand kilometers per second in terms of the broadness. Mm-hmm. So we don't see anything here. There are cases where they do detect the lines that we're looking for, and we just don't see them in these cases.
But maybe the velocity is lower, not 1,000 in the stripped material would be, I mean, it's coming from the companion, so maybe it's not really gonna move so fast. No?
Yeah, I mean, there could be a way you could slow it down or something. I think this is definitely a host line. I'm pretty sure we're pretty confident on that, but it is, you know, it's possible that there could be something narrower that we're missing. But I mean, it's clear that there's no, you know, in most of these cases, there's just not a lot of there's mm-hmm. no broad flux there that we could be looking mm-hmm. for. So
okay, thank you.
Yep.
One last question, dear.
Yeah. You seem to suggest that there was a solution with the nickel coming out to some percentage. You said it produces red emission, too much red emission. Did you consider the radial velocity of the nickel? And what emission line or flux is in the red that's generated by the nickel?
That's a good question. I don't remember off the top of my head. But the way you can sort of reconcile this is if you play with the viewing angle of the supernova, and the velocities, you can possibly change the color that we would observe from it. So we might be able to see a bluer excess flux from this nickel model in that way. Similarly, if you were to take the current models for the companion, in order to not see the lines at late times, you'd have to play with the viewing angle and the separation and things like that. It would require kind of fine tuning, but you can do it as well.
What emission are you calculating for the nickel?
It's just really radioactive decay, I believe, is what's bumping it up. It's just that you have excess nickel at early times that bumps up the supernova flux. But I'd have to look into it. I don't want to... I'll come talk with you later. Sorry.
Okay.
Okay. Do you still want to make your question? Yes. Okay, there was one. Yeah. Just the last question.
I think when you show the residual plot of 18OH, it's a little bit misleading because the magnitude changes so dramatically that pretty much all three possible models fits data extremely well.
Yes.
And these little residuals that you see are probably more likely, you know, instrument artifacts, or just that these one-dimensional models just cannot represent all fine detail that you see in the light curve. So I think the models, including the single degenerate model, fit very well. I don't think you can say that they don't fit very well. This residual plot is misleading.
If I did say that, I didn't. So I think in this case, the single power law model versus a double power law model is pretty clearly a different fit. But as far as the companion versus nickel versus CSM or anything like that, I agree, we can't clearly differentiate between the two.
Yeah.
When I say we thought it was a better fit, it was like, you know, very minute difference.
It's really small, yes.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you very much.